be defined. We have tried for the last 1400 years to carry forward his teachings and his values. And with passing time, we have seen more and more people are joining the caravan of Hussain. Imam Hussain is an epitome of greatness, and his sacrifice for Islamic teachings and values teaches the way forward. The first step is unity among Muslims.
The scholars urge the youth to go deep into the pages of Islamic history to understand the sacrifices Imam Hussein made.
Imam Hussein, Muharram and Karbala have a message, and we have come to promote that message. The events of Karbala teaches us to be steadfast. They teach us the values of sacrifice for truth. They teach us not to give up and not to bow down. They teach us how Imam Hussein and his companions won the battle of Karbala, despite losing their lives. Today, 1400 years have passed, and we have carried the events of Karbala in our hearts and will carry it to our younger generation and won't let anyone forget the greatest sacrifice for the humanity.
The Islamic scholars also reminded people of plots being hatched by enemies of Islam and urged Muslims to stay united.
The enemies of Islam intend to divide us across communal lines. The majority of non-Muslims think Shias and Sunnis are at odds. They call Shia Muslims Husseinis and Sunni Muslims Mohammedans. And this is deliberate. It is aimed at creating a rift among Muslims to divide us, to divide our faith. Hussein alayhi salam is Prophet Muhammad's grandson. So how come we are divided? Such conferences aim to enlighten people about the nefarious designs of enemies and to teach the importance of unity among Muslims.
Religious scholars say the Battle of Karbala was a defining moment in the history of Islam that continues to inspire people regardless of their religion, and the real tribute to the martyrs of Karbala would be to follow their path in letter and spirit. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hussein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus on Sunday. He sat down with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and discussed with him steps taken by both sides to enhance bilateral cooperation with the aim of reaching a higher level of partnership in economy and trade. In the meeting, Assad reaffirmed that the ongoing cooperation between the two countries had positive results in terms of protecting the interests of the two peoples, mainly in fighting terrorism. Abdullahian, for his part, briefed Assad on the outcome of the Baghdad Cooperation and Partnership Conference. He asserted that Iran will continue to support Syria in fighting all forms of terror, mainly economic terrorism.
Both countries are working on a roadmap to develop relations as well as trade and economic cooperation to tackle the sanctions imposed on them. We discussed the latest developments in the region. Improving economic cooperation between both countries' private sector is an important issue which both sides regard as crucial.
The Iranian official also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad. They discussed regional and international developments, saying that foreign presence in the region will not bring security and stability. Maqdad underlined the importance of steadfastness in the face of all Western plots and pressure in order to achieve victory.
We discussed bilateral relations, the situation in Syria and Iran, as well as mutual challenges, the steadfastness of Syria and Iran, as well as all those who want to achieve justice, freedom, sovereignty and independence in our world. We lead them to victory over terrorism and those who question our capability to face challenges.
Abdullahian concluded his meetings by holding talks with heads of Syria-based Palestinian factions, renewing Iran's support for Palestinians' struggle and their fight for their legitimate rights.
Mr. Abdullahian's visit comes shortly after the formation of the new cabinet in Iran. The visit is a reiteration of Iran's steadfast stance towards Syria, based on support to the government and people, in the fight on terror, and for rebuilding the country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
In a press conference, Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip declared the return of nighttime protests also known as night confusion operations along the buffer zone, to reject the Israeli blockade on the enclave.
It is time to end this crippling siege completely. We gave the mediators many chances to end this siege, and there are no more chances for any delay. Our people have got enough of the suffering. We will not leave our positions and won't stop the confrontation until Israel ends the blockade. Israeli settlers nearby won't witness peace as long as our people are not living in peace. We won't stay silent over the misery our people live in.
Palestinian protesters staged a demonstration near the buffer zone, burning tires and launching incendiary balloons at the Israeli army. The demonstrators were voicing their anger at the deteriorating quality of life in the Gaza Strip, caused by a crippling Israeli blockade since 2007. On Saturday, 13-year-old Omar Hassan Abu Nil died of injuries after being shot by the Israeli soldiers during an anti-Israeli protest held a week before.
If the Israeli regime keeps committing these crimes against our people, we will continue the fight and confront the regime here. Israel should know that we are only fighting for our right to live a decent life. This is our land, and we won't leave it, no matter the cost.
Palestinian Resistance Front says it will escalate clashes with Israel as long as the regime keeps its suffocating siege on Gaza, hampering life in the impoverished enclave. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
State security forces on standby in Washington, D.C. were activated today as Palestinians marched toward the White House to condemn the first meeting between U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. That summit was ultimately postponed after a series of bombing attacks in Afghanistan, but protesters were quickly driven out of Lafayette Park regardless. They denounced not just the heavy-handed police tactics, but also President Biden's decision to host Bennett and his refusal to hold Israel accountable for its crimes against Palestinian people.
You're really violating our constitutional rights. To express ourselves in front of the administration, to the administration, and you're just using your power to ask us to.
Let us say that we're here to condemn this visit by this war criminal, the new Israeli Prime Minister, Bennett. He's calling for a war with Iran. He wants a new war against the Gaza Strip. He's not here with a proposal to give the Palestinians their rights.
In a symbolic move, the protesters made their way to the Willard Hotel, where the Israeli Prime Minister is staying, and read aloud the names and ages of Palestinians recently killed by the regime.
Mira Rami Abula, 12. Yasser Rami Abula, 13. Amir Rami Abula, 9.
With Israel stepping up its economic and military siege on the Gaza Strip once again, activists all over the world have renewed their efforts to mobilize for Palestinian liberation. But many say it's right here in D.C. that Israel's real base of power lies. The police aren't letting demonstrators anywhere near the White House. They are keeping Palestinians and their supporters at least 2 blocks away, but that has not kept organizers from staying on the move. They say they won't stop until the Biden administration stops being complicit in Israeli war crimes. Wyatt Reed, Washington.
The holiday season has ended, but the protests against the mandatory health pass are continuing. Only in Paris, 3 different marches took place, dozens all over France. The health pass is an electronic document that people have to show before entering public places. Medical figures show that in areas with more than 70% of people vaccinated, the transmission of the virus and the death qualities are very low. But many people continue to protest because they do not trust the government discourse.
I absolutely don't believe in what they say. We are facing dishonest people, liars. These people want to suppress our liberties and control us.
For me, there is something fishy going on here. I do not have any trust in this vaccine.
But medical figures seem to show the opposite. Today, end of August, 65% of the French population has received 2 jabs of the anti-COVID vaccine. The French health minister, Olivier Véran, himself a neurologist, administered an injection in front of the cameras. He said that people should fear the virus, not the vaccine. French officials say that the COVID crisis is getting under control thanks to the accelerated vaccination campaign and some mandatory measures. In French overseas territories, however, like Martinique, La Réunion or Guadeloupe, the situation is getting out of control because less than 30% of the people there are vaccinated. COVID infections and death casualties are high. Hospitals are full and the lockdown and curfew have been extended. Today, more than 90% of people who arrive in hospitals with severe symptoms of the COVID virus or who die from the virus are non-vaccinated persons. But the mistrust in the vaccine remains high.
Why do they force me to be injected with an unknown product, a pseudo-experimental vaccine? Normally, a vaccine is first tested on animals, then on volunteers. Today, the government threatens and blackmails an entire population. Restaurant workers and health personnel can be fired.
Hospital workers are now obliged to be vaccinated or have to show a negative PCR test. If not, they will be suspended without salary.
Most of the protesters do not deny that the vaccination campaign in France seems to be successful, but they would like the French government to use the method of persuasion rather than a restriction. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepest me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to the Spotlight. The 20-year Afghanistan war has ended in what some have described as a humiliating defeat for the U.S. Even though the U.S. president may state otherwise, other leaders, like the Russian president, have said that the campaign ended in only tragedies and only losses. The Iranian president has said that the war spelled aggression and human rights violations. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will review America's legacy after two decades of war, occupation, and conflict. Joining us for guests for this edition is activist, author, and a member of the Act Now to Stop the War and End Racism from Answer Coalition, Richard Becker. We also have international affairs and security analyst Mark Sloboda, who joins us from Moscow. Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. Let me first start with you, Richard Becker, if I may. First, you have the speech by the U.S. President Joe Biden, in which he said it was an extraordinary success, the evacuation of the Kabul airport. Offered no apologies for either his decision to end the war or in the way that his administration actually executed that. And also, in some respects, though not 100%, he said that the war was a success. Why would he give that kind of impression on this war that many have stated to be otherwise?
Well, I think that one thing that we've learned about our politicians is that they'll say anything that they think is in their own self-interest. You know, the latest phase of the U.S. war in Afghanistan began nearly 20 years ago. It could have ended in November of 2001 when the Taliban leadership basically offered to surrender if given, and their only condition was amnesty. But, you know, we've seen the arrogance, the hubris of imperial arrogance that has manifested by every administration since then, from George W. Bush through Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and now Biden. All lies, lie after lie after lie, misrepresentation after misrepresentation. And meanwhile, we've seen enormous suffering on the part of the people of Afghanistan, of the soldiers who were sent to fight and die and kill from the United States and other countries, the loss of resources. It's estimated now by various sources that the war will end up costing between $4.965 trillion and $5.8 trillion and dollars, and it may go much higher than that. That kind of money could have solved all the problems of the people of Afghanistan and much of the world, but it's gone. It's gone into the pockets of corrupt politicians, and it's gone up in smoke on the battlefield. And now where are we? We're right back at where we were in September of 2001 in terms of who is the government of Afghanistan. So to say in any respect, in any way, to try to claim that that is a victory and that is success, I think just emphasizes what I started out saying, that the politicians will say anything.
Sure. Well, Mark Sloboda, you're there in Moscow. The Russian president has spoken on this occasion, let me quote him when he said, for 20 years American forces were present on this territory. For 20 years they tried, as we can say without offense to anyone, to civilize the people who live there, to instill their own norms and standards of life in the widest possible sense of this word, including when it comes to the political organization of society. The result is only tragedies. Does he have a point?
Well, absolutely. And what the Russian president was saying was not altogether different from actually what Joe Biden was saying. Both, to some extent, were decrying the idea of invasive nation-building military operations. Obviously, the Russian president was expressing it in much stronger terms, but those are exactly the same justifications that Joe Biden used for his withdrawal of military forces and his ending after two decades of the military conflict in Afghanistan. And I think my colleague was dead on the money when he spoke of hubris. And the Russian president is well aware of this because of the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan, in the failure of a socialist nation building there. Now, at the time, there already was a socialist government that was under siege by U.S.-backed, armed, and salaried jihadists, mujahideen. But the situation is much the same at the end result, albeit, you know, the government that the Soviet Union left behind when they withdrew lasted for another 3 years and only eventually collapsed when the Soviet Union dissolved itself and was unable to continue financial aid there. But it's almost a trope, but it is also a truism that Afghanistan has been the graveyard of empires because of this hubristic idea of going in and changing the Afghan people, installing a foreign political, social, and value system. And the Russian president spoke of the need, for understanding the existing people's history, culture, and values. Despite Joe Biden decrying this nation building now, he supported it previously when he was a senator on the Foreign Relations Committee in the United States in the height of the Afghan war. The U.S. obviously still hasn't learned its lesson because it still has a military occupations force in Iraq against the express wishes of the Iraqi parliament. It still has military occupation forces illegally in East Syria. It is still conducting a war on terror operations all across Africa and the Middle East. We can only hope that, Joe Biden reflects further on these continuing hubristic U.S. military operations in pursuit of global hegemony, as he has so tragically learned eventually from the events in Afghanistan.
Well, if we were to take a look at the whole situation in terms of the period of time that this took for it to happen, Richard Becker, when we say 20 years, there's a certain sense of what was translating on the ground, aside from any nation building that's supposed to have happened or any reconstruction, the fact that the military side of it should have proven to be successful in any regards? That is one of the biggest questions and the most repeated questions that is asked, at least based on the type of exposure that I've had, as to how can the U.S. that claims to have the biggest, the most effective, incredible army in the world, not able to defeat the Taliban in the course of 20 years. What was going on there?
You know, it's a very interesting question, and it's a very important question. Matthew Hull, who has become an anti-war activist, but who was in the State Department, said a number of years ago, made this statement. He said, the more the U.S. troops take action inside Afghanistan, this isn't a direct quote, but I think it's close, the more resistance fighters there are. And we can understand that if we saw the way the war was really conducted, that, you know, there was a great deal of the same kind of thing that went on in Iraq, which is the night raid, where, you know, the patrol comes, it busts in the door of a family's house, it terrorizes the people in the house, and maybe it drags away one or more of the members of the household. They end up in a Bagram prison or another prison where they're tortured and abused. And they become, even if they weren't before, they become the active opponents, enemies of the occupation forces. That's very understandable. I think everyone should think about what is it like to live under occupation, and what's the response of the people who are living under occupation. Do they like the occupiers? Well, maybe a few of them do, but the great majority of them resent the fact that their country is under foreign occupation, and that they're treated the way that they're treated by the occupying troops. So that's the reality is that the form of the warfare created more and more and more resistance, and it wasn't only there, it was also in Iraq, it's also been in other countries. But this is the idea, and the idea to wage war in this way is it grows out of a fundamental form of racism, that we can do whatever we want, is the attitude of the occupiers. We can do whatever we want to these people because they're inferior to us, and we're superior to them, and we can crush them. And we've seen, you know, from the war in Vietnam to the wars in Iraq and there's been two of those. That, you know, and the war in Afghanistan, that the reaction is the opposite of what the commanders and occupying forces expect. It's one that their repression, if it doesn't crush the people altogether, will result in greater and greater resistance. And I think that's what we've witnessed the victory of a resistance movement. I'm not a supporter of the Taliban. I think they have very reactionary policies and social policies in many respects, but they are an indigenous resistance movement, and the fact that they were able to achieve victory is due to the fact that they are just that. They are of the people of Afghanistan.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Couple of interesting points, Mark Sloboda, that our guest, Richard Becker, makes. I want to find out from you whether this is indeed what has occurred. You know, this war on terror began back in 2001, officially with the invasion of Afghanistan. And then throughout that time, the U.S. of course, was engaged in other wars also. For example, lots of drone strikes that happened in Pakistan. But basically, the idea that the war on terror actually accelerated resistance fighters, which go against the U.S. That's on the one hand, and then when you take a look at the way that they actually were not successful, whether it's Iraq, Syria, you got Libya. On the other hand, you have Yemen, for example, in terms of their involvement there. How does that make the U.S. look in terms of the way that it's conducted the so-called war on terror?
Yeah, so first of all, the United States does have the largest, best funded, best armed conventional military force in the world. And it's very, very good at taking on another state's armies and overthrowing governments. It's done that quite well in Iraq and in Afghanistan. It drove the Taliban out within a couple of weeks, almost as fast as the Taliban took back the country once U.S. forces withdrew. But when they are tasked with this, the term is no nation building. You know, it's a form of colonialism. They don't understand the native cultures, and invariably they are viewed as an alien occupying force with foreign values. And American troops, you know, they don't understand the cultures, the language, and they do generate insurgency from the native population, often simply by their presence and their attempt to install a foreign political system and values. This becomes a self-perpetuating conflict, which is what, you know, the war on terror very quickly morphed into. It became a war on tribal Islam in parts of the Islamic world where, there was resistance to U.S. military occupation. And then, of course, we have the hypocrisy as well, because the so-called war on terror, at the same time the U.S. was supporting Islamists and jihadists when it was to their interests, in Libya and Syria. And we're talking forces that are directly linked, allied with, embedded with, politically connected with Al-Qaeda. And I don't know how you explain that to the American people, except by not talking about it at all, not acknowledging the truth of that, because the American people, if they understood that, would of course, recoil. I mean, from the forces, that they are told struck them on 9/11. We see this war on terror thus revealed not even so much as the war on tribal Islam, but a war for hegemony, a war for the pursuit of hegemony around the world, particularly in the Islamic world in North Africa, that was resisted in many areas. The best successes they had were by supporting jihadist forces in different areas. That contradiction, lies at the heart of U.S. foreign policy errors and blowback dating back to, the 1980s when the U.S. was supporting the Mujahideen that would eventually morph into the Taliban and Al-Qaeda themselves. So unless the U.S. learns these lessons, this hubris, this pursuit of hegemony at whatever cost and, whatever allies they make or use along the way, then we're just unfortunately going to see this continue as the U.S. press is already talking up the shift to military confrontation with China on the other side of the Pacific, in the South China Sea, or in the Taiwan Straits. It seems that very little has been learned.
Well, I mean, how can that be the view of the U.S. when they have suffered the defeat that they have in Afghanistan, even if there are people, officials, or whomever in power that maybe doesn't believe so, and yet want to confront China militarily or threaten Iran, for example? I mean, how can the U.S. portray its strength when it suffered the way it did in Afghanistan, especially that it couldn't even execute a proper withdrawal from an airport.
Yes. Well, you know, I think that what the U.S. is turning away from is the so-called nation building toward nation destroying. I think that the withdrawal of from the forces in Afghanistan, the wind down of the U.S., some of the, not completely, but some of the U.S. Engagement in the Middle East is meant to facilitate the concentration of forces against China in particular. But you can see that the U.S. policy right now against a number of countries is really aimed at destruction. And I'm talking about Cuba, the tightening of the blockade, which is causing great suffering inside Cuba in the midst of the pandemic, the sanctions being ratcheted up against Iran, against Venezuela, against Nicaragua. And of course, from a military point of view, day in, day out, if you follow any of the military websites, you see the preparation for war against China is going on. So this is a shift, and I think that the Biden administration is counting on the idea that this will be over with, that generally more people want the U.S. out of Afghanistan, a pretty strong majority, and that this will pass by. And meanwhile, the preparation for the most dangerous kind of war anyone can imagine is going forward at a very rapid pace. And this is, so the U.S. strategy, the objective, we are told, is that we must defeat China in the battle for the 21st century. But we should really think, the people of the United States and the people of China have no such interest in this, and I don't think the Chinese government wants to get in that kind of competition either. I know that they don't. But the U.S. government is propagandizing us to prepare us for a new war. Whether or not that war comes to pass or not, we certainly hope not. But this idea that we, the people, should be thinking about our competition with China. We have no interest in a competition with China. We have an interest in friendship and solidarity and cooperation with other countries to face things like global pandemics and climate change and so forth. But instead, what the government of the United States is doing, and the Biden administration is really a kind of neocon administration, is trying to prepare us for the most terrible kind of war that any of us can imagine.
Mark Sloboda, I mean, come on, let's really be realistic. I mean, you talked about the U.S. and how it's going for this military confrontation. I mean, what could China be thinking based on the way that Afghanistan went down and the withdrawal that happened? And not only that, you had Kamala Harris, the VP, that was in that region, trying to muster up and rally nations in that region behind the U.S., that it kind of gets a stamp of approval to go after China, militarily perhaps. What are those nations thinking? When it's their backyard, and here the U.S. is moving full steam ahead. I mean, hasn't this Afghanistan debacle detracted, obviously, from the way that they see the U.S. being an effective force against China?
Well, first of all, the Chinese government, not that it had the same type of hegemonic pretensions that the U.S. did, will certainly take what happened to the United States in Afghanistan as a cautionary tale. And a reflection that over, you know, the last 20, 30 years, China has not engaged in that type of military interventions, at great financial and human cost in the world. And people try to, you know, refer to the coming conflict with China and the United States as an inevitable conflict along the lines of a Thucydides trap, a failing hegemon confronting inevitably a rising hegemon. There's every indication that a powerful China would be qualitatively different than the United States, that they would not suffer from this type of arrogant, imperial, militaristic hubris. What U.S. allies that it is attempting to goad into this conflict, Hopefully they also view this as a cautionary tale about how quickly they can be thrown to the side.
They are. They are.
The Kurds, whether in Iraq or Syria, would have learned this by now. They seem not to have. The forces that the U.S. supports in Kiev and the Ukraine are another indication of this. India, I mean, the U.S. is using this geopolitical term Indo-Pacific, which is, you know, the geopolitical translation of that is the U.S. attempting to dupe 1.4 billion Indians into serving as their cannon fodder in a war with China that India doesn't need. Right. Hopefully they would learn something from this. I don't know if that's evidently, you know, history keeps making the same mistakes again and again.
Yeah, sorry to have jumped in because we're just almost out of time. Last question to you, Richard Becker, in under a minute. You have U.S. allies that are voicing concern, and maybe this time they're going to move ahead with their views, such as the European Union saying, you know, we can't rely on the U.S. Let's have our own army to go ahead with any type of foreign policy adventures that we might want to get into. Even the U.K. that had its defense minister, or Dominic Raab, being questioned and grilled by Parliament, saying, you know, we shouldn't rely on U.S. intelligence all the time. So are we seeing U.S. allies realizing that, you know, the U.S. isn't always right in terms of the way it goes ahead militarily altogether? Under a minute, if you can.
Well, I think that the U.S. views the allies as really instruments in its global strategy of domination. And particularly in the Asian countries, Japan, Okinawa, Taiwan, Philippines, Borneo, this buildup of forces and what the U.S. military leaders called the first island chain shows us exactly how they look at those countries, that they are military assets, that John Foster Dulles years ago called them unsinkable aircraft carriers. That's a horrific way to think about a country, and it's the way that the U.S. leaders look at the other countries as really pawns in their strategy of global domination.
Thank you. We're going to end it there. Activist author and a member of the Act Now to Stop the War and End Racism from Answer Coalition, Richard Becker from San Francisco. And thank you, international affairs and security analyst Mark Sloboda from Moscow. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Tourism. In In the name of God, Salam, and welcome to the seventh episode of our series, Health Tourism. In this episode, we are going to introduce you a leading hospital in Tehran, the Jam Hospital, and get more acquainted with the facilities of this hospital. Please stay tuned. Tehran, capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is a metropolis with a population of more than 8 million, the second most populous city in the West Asia region, and the 24th most populous city in the world. This metropolis is home to a wide range of tourist attractions and fun places to visit, including parks, palaces, old buildings, and many museums. Among the places well worth seeing in Tehran, we can mention Golestan Palace, Niavaran Museum Palace, the Sadabad Complex, Museum of Ancient Iran, Jamshidiya Park, Tochal Complex, and Bird Garden. In addition to hosting many tourists from all over the world every year, Tehran ranks first in Iran for health tourism and attracting foreign patients. The city of Tehran, as the capital of Iran and a modern city, has many welfare and hospital facilities and is home to some world-class experienced doctors and surgeons. This allows prospective health tourists to have a range of options for receiving medical treatment in this city. Many health tourists travel to Iran and seek medical treatment through facilitator companies. These companies, called mentors, help patients choose the best medical specialists and treatment centers based on their experience and knowledge. These companies offer various services such as obtaining visas and making travel arrangements, arranging hospital admission, and hiring interpreters and translators so that the treatment process can proceed more smoothly for health tourists. There are many facilitators in Iran, and especially in Tehran, where tourists can easily identify those that have obtained the required license from Iran's Ministry of Health and submit their applications by simply searching the internet. Dear listeners, we shall now learn more about Jam Hospital, one of the leading private hospitals in Tehran. Stay tuned, please. Jam Hospital is one of the oldest hospitals in Tehran, having been established in the early 1970s. This hospital has been set up along with the advancement of medical science and the development of Iranian universities through the cooperation of a group of famous Iranian physicians. Among these doctors, we can mention Professor Hassan Hashemian, Professor Ibrahim Sami, and Dr. Abdullah Ali Khani. The construction of the hospital started in 1968, and its construction and architecture were entrusted to a group of young Iranian engineers. In 1970, the hospital construction was completed with 9,000 square meters of infrastructure, and in 1974, Jam Hospital, which at that time was considered a well-equipped and modern hospital, began to operate. The hospital, at that time, had 128 beds and 3 advanced operating rooms and was equipped with radiology devices and cardiac equipment. In addition, Jam Hospital was the first private hospital in Tehran at that time to be equipped with a radioisotope facility. Since thyroid disease was very common in Iran at that time, the establishment of this hospital was a great help in treating this illness. Jam Hospital is located in the center of Tehran on Motahari Street, and the access roads are very convenient. This hospital has specialized wards, subspecialized surgery wards, subspecialized clinics, paraclinics, and administrative and logistics units. It also currently has 150 beds, as well as 27 beds in the CCU, ICU, and NICU. In addition, GEM Hospital has 6 active operating rooms ready to serve patients with modern equipment. In the operating rooms of GEM Hospital, thoracic open heart surgery, laparoscopy, neurology, orthopedics, and arthroscopy, obstetrics, general surgery, and cath lab, that is, angiography and angioplasty, are performed 24 hours a day. With the frequent and regular admission of foreign patients in Iran, GEM Hospital was able to obtain a license for its IPD department in the field of health tourism in 2016. The IPD ward of the hospital is a separate unit within the hospital, with all medical staff being fluent in English. Patients are followed up in the hospital for several months after admission to ensure their complete treatment and recovery. In 2018, GEM Hospital provided services to about 700 hospitalized patients and 800 outpatients in the IPD department. GEM Hospital is one of the oldest and most well-known hospitals in Tehran. In 2016, it officially started its work of treating international patients and providing health tourism services by becoming the first hospital to gain the required licenses from the Deputy Minister of Health at a time. GEM Hospital is a specialty acute care hospital. Surgical operations that are usually performed at this hospital include heart surgeries, internal heart surgeries, specialized surgeries for treatment of various types of cancer, general orthopedic surgeries, obstetrics and gynecology, cosmetic surgeries, liver surgeries, endocrine diseases, dentistry, etc. GEM Hospital is one of the most well-equipped and up-to-date hospitals in terms of facilities it offers patients. CT scan radiology equipment, NMR scan, cardiac rehabilitation, and psychotherapy all can be offered to prospective Iranian and foreign patients. Foreign patients mostly go to GEM Hospital for treatment of heart disease, general surgeries, specialized surgeries, treatment of cancer, urological surgeries, chemotherapy, etc. Admission to the International Patient Department, or IPD, in GEM Hospital can be done in several ways. Patients can either refer to the website where they can search from their own country and receive required information, choose their doctors and the hospital, and so on. There are also facilitator companies that arrange hospital admission for international patients. Dear listeners, for direct communication with the GEM Hospital in Tehran, you can apply through the website of this hospital at http://jamhospital.ir or by calling 00981-841-4037 or 00981-841-4557. And get necessary information about the cost of treatment, methods of treatment, medical staff, etc. GEM Hospital is one of the most successful hospitals of its kind in Tehran. It has nearly half a century of experience, outstanding medical expertise, is equipped with the most advanced facilities in the world, offers quality medical services, and really cares for and respects its patients. This has been its recipe for success throughout these years. Dear listeners, that was the 7th episode of our series, Health Tourism. Until our next program, goodbye and God bless.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.